Welcome to Into the Fire, a Burning Coal Theater Company podcast series.
Hi, this is Jerome Davis. I'm the artistic director of Burning Coal Theater Company, and I'd like to welcome everyone to Into the Fire, the Burning Coal Theater Company podcast series on all things theatrical. And do we have a doozy today? We have Alex Donaldson, longtime actor and member of the theater community here in the Triangle, going all the way back, I think, to the 1970s, Alec, when you were in school at UNC.
That is correct, yes. But then with a very long hiatus from about 76 in that range to 2015 when we did Sunday in the Park. The Burning Coal.
That was your first appearance on stage since college, is that right?
That is correct.
I guess I knew that, but I didn't really know it. Alec Donaldson is also an attorney, recently partially retired, although like the mafia, you can never really get away, right?
It can be difficult, but yes.
And you were at Wyrick Robbins, one of the preeminent law firms in Raleigh, a firm that has many things to be proud of. Before that, you and I worked together at Moore and Van Allen downtown when I first moved to Raleigh. Tell me a little bit about the transition from theater major or theater actor participant to lawyer.
Well, that evolved over several years, but the real impetus was, I guess, away from the theater, and that was simply realizing I'm not good enough to make this transition, to really be in it full time. And partly after college, I was involved with the theater in Richmond, Virginia. The museum there had an Equity House theater, and I was an intern for a year there and doing stage manager and jobs like that and taking a tour out, etc. And we had a very scandalous it turned into a scandal. This is 1977, I recall correctly. And the theater produced a show, a Romulus Linney play based on the life of Lord Byron. And in that play, they have Lord Byron kiss a young man. Richmond freaked out. And funding was threatened to be pulled. Donors were saying, I'll never give you another cent. The artistic director, packed up his bags, and to where he went, I don't know. And I thought, I don't want to be in a situation where I may have to, decide, okay, really like Richmond, but here I'm going off to Cleveland. And then in 5 years go off. I'm not a peripatetic sort. And I just thought I need something more permanent, more certain in my life. And that I knew could afford me a life that I wanted to live. So that is how I got away from the arts. Always interested and stayed involved. And after law school, I think every year but one, I was on the board of some arts-oriented nonprofit board for all that time. And then it was just when Burning Coal announced they were doing Sunday in the Park, I looked at you and I said, oh my God, I would kill to play Jules. And you said, well, can you sing? And I said, well, I think I can. And he said, well, then you should audition because I can totally see you in that role. And I said, oh, pull the other one. No, I'm not going to. No. And 3 weeks later, I thought, well, what have you got to lose? And off I toddled to Burning Coal to audition, walked in the lobby. It was terrifying, filled with all these young people. They all knew each other, and they all had their 8x10 photos, and they had their sheet music, and I hadn't anything. And I just walked in there. I did my monologue, and I remember Emily Rainey looking not pleased. And maybe it was not me. It may have just been having her serious directorial face on. And you were there, and also Ian Finley. And then I just opened my mouth and started singing. And then you very sweetly cast me. And so I try to do one show a year. And that's so far been my record generally. COVID obviously put a damper on that.
Yeah, that's almost how I remember it. The slight variation in my version of it is that you begged me for 3 weeks for that role, and I finally gave in. But, you know, somewhere in between probably is the real, lies the real truth.
Somewhere in between, very close to my recollection.
So had you done musicals when you were at UNC, when you were a playmaker?
I only was in one play. What's it? Sebastian in Twelfth Night. Other than that, it was not playmakers in the theater there, and it wasn't part of playmakers, but there were other student productions at the drama department. But yeah, there were, I mean, Babes in Arms is the one that comes to mind. There may have been one or two others. It wasn't a whole lot. Again, I did a little bit, you know, sort of did acting class the first year and things like that. But I was more interested at that point. I really like performing that in particular. I love musicals, but I started sort of moving away and thinking, oh, well, really more go into, you know, theater management or something like that as I was
Sure.
trying to grow up.
Less competition and in some ways even more important. If there isn't a well-managed theater, then there isn't an opportunity for those actors. So that makes perfect sense to me. And had you been studying law at the same time, or did you begin that
No.
after you finished?
No, after I stopped the job at the Virginia Museum Theater, I really didn't know what to do. I mean, I did the usual sort of, you know, go get some retail gigs while trying to figure out. And I was like, okay, well, business school, law school. And I took a few courses, you know, like a business course or two at one of the colleges there that they had open, and quickly realized, I mean, some of it was interesting, but I cannot abide numbers, and it's just not me at all. I just did not care for it, and so decided, well, law, that would make sense because I like to read, I like to write, I like analyzing language, so that's where. So I yeah, it was a paralegal for a year, and to make sure that I felt like I liked it, and
That
then
was smart, yeah.
and went to law school.
Now, and did you feel that there was a you know, it's sort of a cliche, but that lawyers are performers too. Was that part of the draw, or no?
No, not at all in my case. Although there is something to that, because I mean, I never wanted to go into the courtroom at all, and that's where the performing is.
Yeah.
In a trial advocacy course in law school, I remember, you know, giving my closing arguments or walking back and forth in the room and just seeing these, you know, the faces turn, the eyes watch me, and I thought, ooh, this is fun. But that was as close as I came. But I mean, it is very theatrical. When I then went off the law firm that I joined, it just, you know, tagging along with, because they wanted to get you exposed, and so tagging along with some of the litigators to their courtroom proceedings, and just seeing, you know, how those guys, as well as the other people in court, you know, just again, how they present something with a flourish or with a tone of voice, et cetera. But not in the corporate law world. No, we don't get to do those sorts of expressions.
It's more contract law and stuff like that.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, there are also, if Morin Van Allen is any example, there are quite a number of theatrical characters in that industry.
Yes. Yes, I would say yes.
That's your shortest, your shortest answer of the day.
Well, people are people, you know, and you find all sorts in no matter what field or country or place you want to look.
Yeah, I worked on Wall Street for 3 years when I first moved to New York, at a 80-year-old brokerage house. And talk about characters, my God, it was wild. You wondered how the economy ever, I mean, they were brilliant people, but they were so scattered and disfocused and had all sorts of interests beyond, you know, their work. And Well, let's talk a little bit about the board. You said you'd been on boards for much of your adult life. And I know that your wife, Georgia Donaldson, is also very frequently around the arts, as board member, contributor, donor, fundraiser. Why do you do that?
I think, well, one, we really love the arts, and particularly the performing arts. I mean, that's what we really, really love. And so, when we could help out, then, we would. And it's fun. I mean, Georgia particularly, but I as well. I mean, a fundraiser is like it's an event, and it's that gets our sort of creative juices flowing in a way of like, oh, well, let's do this. And how about this for a theme? Oh, and we could get this and that. It's a creative process to, pull something together. And it is nice. I mean, it's a relatively short-term commitment, with a very specific goal, and date. And that I guess is appealing to me.
But
I mean, it'd be a
you're also on boards, and that is anything but a short-term commitment. What's
That
the
is,
attraction there?
again, I like the, it's the organization and what the, and or what the organization does to help, again, the arts in the community. And I can't say I was specifically told or instructed, growing up, but it was just sort of assumed, I guess, that, all right, here you are, you need to go out and help do stuff and support the things that you want to, see flourish.
Right.
So that's
Some people
awesome.
volunteer at food banks or do Habitat for Humanity build outs, and some people work in the arts in that way. Can you tell me a little bit about some of the other organizations? You were our board president for a number of years and on the board longer than that, but what are some of the other organizations you have supported in that way over the years?
Well, let's see. When we lived in New Bern after law school, I was on the Arts Council down there. I was on the Historic District Commission down there too, because I do like old buildings, etc. And that was my basically 6-year gig there. And then when we got to Raleigh, picked up with, because I was at a fundraiser somewhere, and some got to know someone. They said, "Oh, well, I'm on the board of Arts Together, and so we just talked about that, and she said, "Well, I'm going to be rolling off soon. Can I throw your name as a potential, replacement?" And so I was, I think, basically Arts Together for 6 years. That led to you not know CORAC, City Raleigh Arts Commission. I was on that for nearly six, then segued into United Arts. And then after 6 years, and then after United Arts, it was Burning Coal.
For those who don't know, CORAC and United Arts are grant-making agencies. The City of Raleigh Arts Commission, or CORAC, is a governmental entity that's funded through taxpayer, an assessment. I think it's $5.50 per person per year who live in Raleigh. And then United Arts is kind of a quasi-governmental agency. They're not directly affiliated with Wake County, but they're kind of a countywide agency that collects money through donations and then distributes it to the arts as well. And then we're very fortunate here to have the State Arts Council as well, which is three different tiers of funding that arts organizations have access to. And that's not true in many other places. I don't think New York City has three. I know they have the State Arts Council there, and they have an arts council for New York City. But I don't think there's a countywide thing. So we are very blessed here in many ways with that. And I think one of the reasons why those things have been successful over the years is that people like yourself have put their backs into it. and put their names out in front of it. Something that people don't really understand, but if you're looking for the city council or the legislature to pass a funding bill, you know, you'd better have some of the quote unquote right people behind it, or it's far less likely to succeed. And I don't know that that's ideal, but it is probably the only way that it realistically could happen in the world in which we live. It would be great that everybody just said, oh, that's a good idea, let's do it. But oftentimes what they're saying is, who will look favorably on me if I do that? And so having, you know, stalwarts of the business community behind the arts is absolutely fundamental to any city's cultural life, I think. Do you have artists who inspire you?
There are many performers. Beyond the performing arts, I mean, certainly, you know, painting speaks to me when I see certain ones. And we do go to museums a lot. Because it's not specifically limited to any particular artistic field. I sort of like to think that, you know, art is, if people really think about it, it's everywhere. I mean, it seems to me that some people, particularly who, you know, think that arts are frivolous, et cetera, it's like, well, you listen to the radio, you know, you watch television, that's art.
License plate on your car is a work of art.
Yeah, I mean, and the buildings around you, I mean, they could be ugly, they could be beautiful, they could be whatever, but that is, I mean, it's a human expression. So I find, to me, it's just part of life and how you, well, I, that's the way I see it.
I'm asking a leading question because I was expecting you to bring up Stephen Sondheim fairly quickly when I asked that question. But since you didn't, I'll bring him up for you. Sondheim, you know, you said that when you heard that we were doing Sunday in the Park with George, you jumped at it. And I believe the phrase you used was beg Jerry for 3 weeks to do the part. Oh, wait, maybe that was my phrase. But my question is, you know, how many lawyers know Sunday in the Park with George? There aren't that many. And so I would think that Sondheim, and of course, when Little Night Music came along, you were also in a prone position. No, that's not true. You indicated a serious interest in being involved in the production, I believe. And
yes.
Whether you did or not, I definitely wanted you in it. And so talk about Sondheim a little bit. How does his work particularly inspire you? And if so, why? He's often writing about very esoteric things. He doesn't write much about, for instance, the South, which is where we live, or modern times really that much. He tends to write about historical figures much more.
In a way, I mean, of course, Company, and then his posthumous one, Here We Are. I mean, it's much more timely. You're right. I mean, I love his work. I love the music. Like I said, I love musicals. I always have. So I saw my first one when I was 6 years old. And I was sold.
What was the musical?
It was the original run, not the original cast, but it was the end of the third year run of My Fair Lady in New York.
Wow.
So a long way back. And I just remember thinking, oh my God, grownups up there doing that. Where do I sign up?
Somebody's getting paid to do that.
Or just doing it. I didn't even know they were paid. I was just like, I want to do that. So I love musical. I love to sing. I absolutely love to sing. I'm not trained in it. I don't know how to read music. I can know if the notes are going up or down, but I can't pull a note, you know, out of the air. With experience, I've certainly learned some ability to maneuver, very rudimentary. But I love to sing. I think with Sondheim, also, I do think as beautiful as other shows and earlier shows are, to me, there's such poignancy in so many of Sondheim's songs, because I think he really is writing much more internally for a character than, say, a Rodgers and Hammerstein, where it's, oh, I'm avowing how I feel. This is how I love you. Look at me. This is what love is to me. And it is more, that's more, I think, sort of universal, where Sondheim really becomes very much more personal. Yeah. And is in a way sort of those interior dialogues and those struggles of, wait, I'm not sure. And how can you be? I mean, as a younger man, I was I devoured, I think, every single thing that Virginia Woolf ever wrote, because of that dichotomy of the beauty of life, but I love it, but it ends, and feeling like, oh, I am part of the world and I love these people. And then there are times when you just feel like, I feel so alone, that's not. I mean, I have that. It's not something that I live with constantly. It's not some, I do think that most people have those moments where you do feel very divorced and you just think, wait a minute, this is so weird. We're these creatures walking around. But then you do have those moments where you are just completely involved with other people.
Yeah. There's something about the impulse to to tell a story, which is really what theater is, and that in its simplest form is the impulse to communicate with another human being, to say either this is what happened, or more deeply, this is what I think about what happened.
Mm-hmm. along those lines, I also think that shared live theater, that shared experience, when you see it's just unlike anything else. I mean, it is just, you are there. People are putting their emotions out there. I think you respond to a film performance. It's not the same. That immediacy and that connection, and you have a whole audience around you being moved by it. It's really, really something.
Yeah,
to me.
We can tell that by the fact that film is an industry and theater really is an art form. There are people who have tried over the centuries to make it into an industry, but I don't know that it ever entirely has been done that done to it, where the commercial aspects of something becomes, sort of outweighs the intrinsic value of sitting in a room with a bunch of your neighbors and thinking about the great ideas of our time. Something that Sondheim does in all of his work, I think, and very subtly so. Let's talk just a little bit about A Little Night Music. When people think of Sondheim, I think it's not one that they think of, except for Send in the Clowns, which was only, in that regard because it was popularized by pop musicians.
Judy Collins, yeah.
Yeah, that's right, among others. And so talk to me about A Little Night Music a little bit. You're playing one of the five Liebersliters in the production, who are this sort of Greek chorus who sort of help us tell the story. Tell me just a little bit about that. How are you thinking about your character in the play, and how are you thinking about the play as a story?
Oh, see, this is where I'm not good at these deep questions. But for my character, as you said, it's a Greek chorus, so there's not a specific, anything assigned to either of the quintet members by the script. And so it's more just, okay, well, what sort of a person would I be at that period in time? And because it is set in, you know, upper class, upper middle class, because it's about those sorts of foibles and expectations that people put on themselves and others because of positions that they hold or think they should hold, et cetera. At least that's part of what's going on in the play to me. I mean, I sort of looked at myself, my internal sort of story about it, and I really didn't think about this until Gigi, the choreographer, asked us to really, you know, put down in words. And I said, I think my character really would be, basically would be Honoré Le Chat from Gigi, just somebody who didn't really have to worry about doing anything except pursuing what he felt was interesting. And always being polite about it and playing by the rules, even though we know we're bending the rules, those strict rules of, like, you know, all right, this is what the church says, and this is what the vows you took say, and this is what society upholds and says you can't go beyond, but people always have and always will go beyond those. But it is this veneer of, okay, well, we may be doing that, but we really don't admit it, or it doesn't get out. It's not broadcast, certainly. And so I play it from that. And so it is, it's winking, you know, knowing looks and winks and things like that to, among the various characters.
Innuendo, like crazy. I'm thinking about his play Passion, which also kind of delves into that idea. I saw a preview performance of that before it opened on Broadway originally, and Sondheim was about five rows behind me, pacing back and forth, and they had blocked off the last few aisle rows so that he could pace back there and while he watched the performance. And there's that moment in it, you know, you have the sense that you're watching a story about these two golden children that are being set upon by this kind of harpy, you know, who wants to break apart their love. And then there's a line that's almost a throwaway line halfway through the play where you hear that, in fact, the golden girl in that relationship is married to somebody else. And it just cracks the whole thing open. I mean, it felt like a hole in the floor had opened up because the play had set that up so clearly, those boundaries into which we not only do we think we have to live by, but we also expect that others will live by them as well. And when we find out they don't, what a cataclysm, an emotional cataclysm.
Anna Karenina, you know, we know you've stepped beyond the bounds, but you have now gone so far beyond the bounds that, you know, she kills herself. Because her entire world disintegrates.
Right. They used to write about that back in the day, but Sondheim continued to throughout his life. I think he was interested in manners. You know what they used to call them, a comedy of manners, and he's very much interested in that. You know, and in that regard, as a descendant of you know, Molière and. People
right, like, and the restoration playwrights, I think,
Oliver Goldsmith. Anything else about night music you'd like to bring up before we wrap up our conversation today, Alec?
I mean, I certainly hope people come to see it. It's a beautiful show. It is a beautiful. The music is beautiful, and wait till you hear the cast singing in that space. It really is something. It is the most challenging music I've ever had to sing, but it is, it's glorious. And the story is terrific. It's a lovely book. I think it's probably the best, almost one of the best books of his musical. I mean, Sunday in the Park, Into the Woods. The others sort of veer off in different directions a little bit, but I don't think they're as strong. Yeah. But those three, it's a terrific cast. I think the staging is very inventive. I'm really I'm looking forward to remembering everything I have to do. I'm not there yet.
I will give you the opportunity to go remember that now. And go ahead and sign off by saying that A Little Night Music by Stephen Sondheim and Hugh Wheeler will open at Burning Coal Theater Company on April 4th and run through the 21st. Thursdays through Saturdays at 7:30 p.m., Sundays at 2 p.m. Tickets are available on our website, which is burningcoal.org, or by calling us at 919-834-4001. I will also say that Alec Donaldson, who has graced the Triangle community now for decades with his guidance and support and artistry, will be appearing in the production. So for that alone, you should make the trip down. But yes, the cast of 16 is well worth the journey. So Alec, thank you very much. And I will see you at rehearsal.
Thank you, Jerry.
Take care.